coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is June 1st, 2018, and this is episode 88. Politicoast is your weekly politics recap with a West Coast perspective. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe and leave a review wherever you found us. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, where we're at PoliticoastPod, and support the show at patreon.com/politicoast.
I'm Scott Blindboom.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. The BC Legislature's spring session ended this week, but we're not going to do a recap on that. We just did one on episode 85, and you can go back and listen to that. A bunch of other stuff happened this week, so we're going to be talking about the trade war that erupted yesterday. The details, at least the recommended details for the electoral reform referendum, and we check in on what the fuck's going on in Ontario with John Michael McGrath from TVO. First, though, we have to, as always, thank our premier sponsors, Lindsay Tedds and Blake Hodson, for helping make the show possible. And Politicoast is in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's brand new daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for your free trial and have unique coverage of the BC Legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners, you get 25% off your subscription when you enter the offer code Politicoast, all lowercase. For your free two-week trial, go to britishcolumbiatoday.ca. And just a bit more housekeeping before we dive into today's show. Cambie Report's going to put on our first live show on Monday, June 11th, pretty much a week from today. We're going to be over at the Emerald in Chinatown doing a show starting roughly 7:15. We'll see. Doors at 6. Find details on the Cambie Report Twitter or Facebook page, and we'll put a link in the show notes. And also, you fucked up last week. Or earlier this week, right?
So one bit of housekeeping. On our emergency pod that we did Tuesday about the pipeline buyout, I off the cuff made a remark that I thought maybe the government had come out ahead on the auto bailout. Turns out I was just having a brain fart, and turns out the government actually lost a couple billion dollars on that one, and I was thinking of one of the other bailout packages that did end up coming out ahead, and just crossed the two in my mind. But thanks to Bell Seat for pointing that out to us on Twitter.
I think someone else tweeted we at us as well.
Yeah, but we got two people who'd made a note of that. So yeah, I appreciate the fact check.
Always fact check us, because it always sounds a bit better, I find, if we talk overly confident in everything we say, which is just a perfect white male way to do a podcast.
In other words, a podcast.
Yeah. Let's go into segment one. Trade war. What is it good for?
Absolutely nothing.
We've had a ton of time, and we've spent a ton of time talking about Alberta-BC trade wars, but let's look at how Canada and the US are butting heads over NAFTA and tariffs. You've been following this a bit closer.
So U.S. Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross announced the other day that the U.S. was actually going to follow through on something they'd been threatening for a little while now of imposing tariffs of 25% on imported steel and 10% on imported aluminum, and that they weren't going to exempt Canada and Mexico from that, which they were considering for a while, and with this announcement they've decided, no, you know what? Canada, yeah, we're going to attack them on trade as well.
And they were citing national security concerns on this. Is that just their way to get out of NAFTA?
So there's a WTO exemption for national security things. And, you know, it made sense. You want to be able to have a shipbuilding industry should you need a Navy in a time of crisis. And Navy ships require a fair bit of steel. So there's an argument on why that exemption should exist in trade law. The thing is, Canada and the U.S. are basically as close as you can be in terms of national security partners. You know, our intelligence services have a fair bit of integration. Our militaries have a huge amount of cooperation between them. I believe they're our largest supplier of military hardware. Like, it's, you know, we've fought and died beside each other in many wars. Like, it's not the sort of thing that, you know, anyone could really doubt that, you know, if the U.S. got into war, that we wouldn't sell them steel.
So Ross announces these tariffs, and Canada decides to up the ante, or at least match them buck for buck.
Yeah, it was a tit-for-tat response on our part. We were also going to put 25% tariffs on steel, and 10% tariffs on aluminum, and a whole bunch of other products.
They listed 100 over 100 different things, I think, on their website. And it's amusing to scroll through the list because it includes beer kegs, whiskey, toilet paper, hair liqueurs, inflatable boats.
Yeah, so in addition to the specific things that were just mirroring, namely steel and aluminum, there's also all of these other tariffs were applying. And I believe what CBC did a decent look at why some of these were chosen, and the short answer is it depends on where they are made, and specifically who represents the states and districts where these items are made. So a lot of these were chosen because they're made in places where key members of Congress, key senators, and potential swing states happen to be. So bourbon, for example, which is tariffed at 10% under the as a whiskey, on the list is Mitch McConnell's home state.
Yeah, but he has no spine. He's not going to stand up on anything. But some of the others.
Some of the others. So, for example, toilet paper raised a few eyebrows on why that was included. Turns out the Scott Paper Company is located in Pennsylvania, which was a fairly narrow Trump victory in the last election after the state had gone Democrat for 6 elections in a row. So it's one of those things where you're going to put pressure on key swing states and key members of Congress.
This is well pointed out. I mean, the Trudeau government has actually done pretty good behind the scenes lobbying. Like, the reason Trump hasn't torn up NAFTA yet is probably largely because Chrystia Freeland and Stephane Dionne before her were spending a lot of time talking to the right people in Washington.
Well, not just them. Like, pretty much every member of cabinet has made multiple trips down to the U.S.
And not just generic ones, but very targeted lobbying going after all these people. You know, they managed to get a lot of the rhetoric against supply management even turned down. And then it just seems like, oh, Trump had a bit of a meltdown this week and turned his sights back on NAFTA, and now he's talking about tearing it up again and replacing it with individual deals, which is a Brexit approach to negotiations.
Well, that's working out. And there's also the looming question of whether or not Trump can even unilaterally do that, which is kind of unresolved, I believe, at this moment, because NAFTA is being enabled through legislation and you need Congress to repeal that, so it gets complicated. But yeah, in the meantime, we're now suddenly in a trade war as of this week.
Which means a lot of things might get more expensive for Canadians this summer, and I guess probably also Americans,
yes,
because trade wars inevitably end up hurting citizens more than anyone else.
Well, yeah, and that's how you fight a trade war. It's basically shooting yourself in the foot in hopes the ricochet hurts someone else, because like all of these tariffs that Trudeau's put in just raise the price for Canadians. They don't actually hurt America directly. It's only the fact that now their stuff's more expensive because Canadians have to pay more for it. But ultimately, it's all of these measures hurt the citizens of the country that's implementing them. And not only that, you also have the problem that, you know, happened in the Great Depression. And, you know, if Trump actually knew anything, you know why these are such a bad idea, is that steel has a lot more downstream users of it than people who work in the steel industry. And it's going to make a whole bunch of things, from cars to buildings to everything, more expensive. And like, I already know people here who are working construction who are looking at changing to more wood-based construction as a result of this, simply because steel's going to go up in price in Canada as a result.
So what is Canada's justification for this? Like, the U.S. made
it purely
national security. But then do we not face reaction at the WTO or any of this other?
No, because there's kind of an understanding that you can put in place retaliatory measures. Also, like, Europe got hit with these as well, and they've responded in kind as well. So this was basically a giant fuck you from Trump to everyone who's allies with America.
I can see the justification for Canada putting a maple syrup tariff on, because we want to protect our key industries.
Well, I think
that's more joking, right?
Yeah.
We're going after specific Vermont.
Yeah, although any Canadian who buys Vermont syrup should be tries for treason anyway, but like that.
But so you were pointing out one of the humorous tariffs on our podcast account that Trudeau has actually put a tariff on pipelines right after we bought one.
Yes. So one of the items is line pipe of a kind used for oil and gas pipelines of stainless steel, as well as line pipe of a kind used for oil and gas pipelines other. So that pipeline that we're apparently now going to spend $7.5 billion at least to build just got more expensive because we're now putting a 25% tariff on U.S. steel. And Canada is a net importer of steel, and the U.S. is by far the largest place we import it from. So this is absolutely going to raise the price of steel in Canada, and we're tariffing pipeline parts as we're about to start building a pipeline.
I mean, we could have that made in China steel and slap that sticker on it.
They actually are our number two source of steel, followed by South Korea.
Yeah.
So, although with some of the Chinese steel problems we've had, and I'm sure our listeners in Victoria are all too familiar with that one. Yeah, maybe we're best buying from South Korea on this one.
The other thing I noticed in here is, for some reason, the media still fact checks Trump and doesn't just say he's full of shit, but he was making claims that a lot of this was driven by trade inequities between Canada and Europe. And he's talked about how the trade surplus he has with Mexico means Mexico is going to pay for the wall through that. And the Toronto Star actually had a fantastic line. U.S. data has consistently shown that the U.S. has a trade surplus with Canada. Canadian data, calculated differently, has shown that Canada has the surplus. Regardless, economic analysts agree the relationship is largely balanced and that the existence of a surplus or deficit is not a good way to measure the quality of a trade relationship. Which is just like, let's stop talking about this stupid, trivial matter.
Yeah, Trump has a very zero-sum way of thinking about it, and a trade surplus or deficit is not how one, quote-unquote, wins at trade.
So NAFTA has been under renegotiations for 9 months. Trump is threatening again to tear it up. Whether or not he can, we'll find out. Now we have tariffs going every which way, and everyone's life's going to get a bit more expensive. What's next?
I don't know. Trade wars in general are stupid, and with Trump leading one side of it, I'm not optimistic, let's say.
Well, if you don't like Trudeau's proposed tariffs, you have until June 15th. You have 2 weeks to add your public comments to them. If you think we should tariff more things than just the 100, let's tariff everything from the States.
You probably can add have not been listening in. To our show if you do, but...
And then the goal is for all these tariffs to kick in on July 1st. Kind of a Canada Day present to ourselves. Not a great one.
I like the legal pot better as the Canada Day present.
Yeah, but we're not getting that.
Yeah, we're not getting that either, so... This year's just been full of disappointments. Moving on to our second segment, electoral reform to the moon. This week, the Attorney General released the report on and recommendations for how we're going to hold the whole electoral reform referendum. Turns out we're not waiting until September to finally announce it, which they'd floated and everyone pretty quickly said, no, that's a terrible idea. So instead we got it this week, and it's going to be a two-part ballot. So first question is, should the BC government use first past the post or a proportional representation system to elect its members? And then if that goes in the way of a proportional representation system, the second question is which one? And three options were proposed. There's dual member proportional, mixed member proportional, and rural urban PR. So the premier, of course, was out talking about how great these proposals are and giving his full support to the referendum. And when asked about whether or not it was too complicated, he basically compared it to the Apollo program where they relied on experts and said that Canada, yes, do you want to go to the moon? Yes. So how should we do that? That's what we got to figure out. And said the choice would be left up to the experts to sort out the exact details around the gaps in the report.
So this report comes after David Eby ran the big consultation, and he's want to tell everyone that this is the biggest consultation we've ever had in BC, which seems true. They had 91,000 people, almost 92,000 people complete a questionnaire. 180,000 people hit the website. 1,100 people were pulled into in-person panels, it sounds like. They had 46 organizations, 208 individuals submit briefs. So they got a lot of feedback on this, which is fantastic. I know I heard some of the traditional media folk bemoaning that, oh, this is just a tiny fraction of the electorate. But it is a consultation. The referendum is what counts in terms of turnout.
And you're never going to have a significant fraction of the electorate at a consultation.
So they did all that, and you can go through the report, and I skimmed it a little bit to see what the results of that were. And for the most part, it seemed like he tried to center his recommendations around those, but there were definitely some places, and I don't remember them offhand, but that he chose to divert. Like, I think one of them was most people do not like the idea of the government giving the money to the pro and con sides, but ultimately they said, yeah, we're going to give $500,000 to the pro and con side each to debate this. And that can just be a priority of the government and of the attorney general rather than what most people think they would want to see. The two questions is an interesting way to do it. It's been pushed back and forth. A lot of people on both the yes and no side wanted to see first past the post versus system X, whatever it is. If it's mixed member proportional, if it's one of these fancy two versions of pretty much mixed member proportional, although rural urban has an STV component.
It's more STV in that one.
It depends where you live. You say that because you live in the city where you get STV. If you live in the country, you get MMP, but it's really simple.
I'm just disappointed STV didn't get a spot on
STV was defeated twice. You can like put asterisks around that.
If we didn't have a stupid threshold, we'd be voting under STV for several elections now.
They gave us these three systems, gave us the two questions. I kind of like the idea of doing two questions. It does make it a bit more complicated because advocates for proportional representation now have to try to convince you that they're all better than first past the post, because if any of these look toxic and you would never risk going to, I don't know, rural urban for some reason, you think that's the worst system ever, or maybe you hate MMP, then you'll vote to stick with the status quo rather than risk it. But maybe this will work. Maybe you'll go, because they're all kind of the same in my mind. But he picked these three, he says, because the values they came up with was that people don't really want to see the legislature increased. So even though the easiest way to make sure we keep all the ridings the same size is to just add 40 more MLAs or more, people don't like the idea of hiring more politicians for some reason. So I think at most he was suggesting we'd go from like 87 to 95.
Yeah, MLAs. 95 was the cap on all of it.
He also said no region of the province should have fewer MLAs than it currently has, and no political party should be eligible if it leaves 5% of the vote, the Nazi cutoff, even though the Nazis got 30% in the end or something like that. But
consider it the communist cutoff too, if you're on the other side.
Yeah. So he comes up with these three systems. I think we've talked about MMP before in our electoral reform deep dive that looked at the federal level. We're actually going to get the guy who invented dual member proportional on the podcast to walk us through what that is. But basically, you vote for a pair of candidates in every riding. You just have a nice simple ballot.
Party puts up to two candidates in an order. You basically vote like you do right now, except there's two names per line rather than one. First seat just goes to whoever gets the most votes as the top line person, and then the rest are distributed based on the overall provincial vote. And who that second person is gets complicated, but it's basically like, I think whoever has the strongest showing provincially, like across the board among the redistributed seats. The report's a little fuzzy on the exact how it gets distributed. And interestingly, independents get elected if they're in the top two. And if an independent gets number two in a riding, that riding's just everyone's there and none of the redistributed seats come from that riding.
And like we said, we'll get the guy who created it on and drill him down on this, assuming the cabinet picks these up, which seems safe at this point. The third option is this rural urban PR or flexible district PR, where cities are combined into multi-member ridings. So the city of Vancouver would be combined into a riding of like 6 or 7 people, and some of the suburbs would get their own large constituencies, and they would vote using an STV system where you just rank the people, and then magic math happens and it picks the top 5 or 6 people or whatever in that constituency. And then the rural areas would get to vote in a first-past-the-post system for their constituency, with a second ballot to vote for a party, and you'd get MMP top-ups. So you'd get proportional both in the city and in the country, but in different ways. And the reason to do this is to prevent the rural districts from ballooning in size, because dual member proportional, for example, requires you to double the size of a district.
So like the northern third of BC would just be one riding in that
case. I think there's a little asterisk in this system that they might keep some as single member ridings just to stop that. But
like under STV, that would be the problem where like half the province would be one riding.
Yeah. And so that becomes one of the first things the Liberals have already strongly critiqued, is we're given these three systems, but they're a bit vague on the details. Like, we don't have maps of what it would look like. We don't know the full counting methods, which like 6 people care about, but some people think it's really important because it makes it complicated. The 6 people are poli-sci wonks. The maps question, though, the way the report has structured it is, if the referendum goes through, what David Eby suggests is that the legislature form an all-party committee where no one has a majority, and that group settles all the final details except the maps. The maps would go to Independent Electoral Boundary Commission again, and they would do what they always do, and that's redraw maps in a relatively nonpartisan way, which means we don't get gerrymandering. I think the part of the problem with past electoral reform efforts is people get hung up on the minutiae of a map, of saying, why is the line on my road and not that road? I'm going to vote against this because it annoys me personally. And then you have the like problem of the individual not being able to see the forest through the tree.
So also included in here is proposal that after 2 elections, there would be another referendum to basically say, should we go back or should we make the system we've adopted the permanent one? So good safety valve, I guess, and might put some people's minds at ease. Although I will note the future parliament could always just decide to ignore it by changing the law.
They could also just change the law and revert us back to first past the post.
Yes.
Which has happened. Like when BC brought in instant runoff voting, because I saw Andrew Wilkinson out there talking about how BC has always had this one system we've known for 150 years, and now we're going to some risky changes. We've had variations on a majoritarian system. We've had multi-member districts. We've had runoff voting. That gave us the Socreds when everyone hated the other options. But most of those changes just happened with a legislative stroke of the pen and a couple votes. But we're in referendum era now, so we'll get one referendum with 2 questions and then another one. And David Eby points out that 2 elections might feel like a long time, but if this system is as terrible as they say, and you know, we have an election under mixed member proportional, it results in a minority that's unstable and can't work it out, then we'll have another election right away, and then you're done your 2 elections. We have to have another referendum. So we could have a very exciting year of 2 elections and a referendum.
Oh, I'm no shortage of content for the podcast.
There's a few nuts and bolts of the recommendations that seem fairly uncontroversial, that the campaign should run from July 1st to November 30th. It'll be a mail-in ballot from October 22nd to November 30th. The chief electoral officers in charge of giving out neutral information and choosing a pro first past the post and a pro proportional group, which they're pretty much already lined up. Like we said, they both will get $500,000 from the government under these proposals. They'll also be able to fundraise using the same rules as the legislature has. So I think whatever personal donation limits, no corporate union donations, those kind of things. And there will be requirements for third parties, I think, to register and have some limits on their spending. So overall, it seems like fairly reasonable recommendations. Everyone's already thinking they're horribly biased in one way or the other. So there's still no turnout requirements. There's still a 50% plus one on the first question. The second question is also requires a majority, but you will rank those three choices. And the least popular one, if none make 50%, gets dropped and the votes get redistributed.
Seems super simple, although I'm very curious to know what the spoiled ballot rate's going to be on that one, because you have two different methods of marking how many people are going to...
I was looking at that for the PEI referendum, where they got to rank the different possible electoral systems, including first past the post, and 95% of votes were still counted on the like fifth ballot. So most people actually did rank more than one thing.
That is promising, although that is one ranking, not a check one, then rank.
Yeah, and first past the post was one of them, so those people never had their ballot dropped off. Honestly, I kind of like all three of these systems. They all have merits and strengths and weaknesses. I think I like the rural-urban just because it's the wonkiest and kind of gives like STV where it works good and lets MMP sort of solve the rural issues, because people in Vancouver don't really know who their MLA is, or at least the way it is right now. There are rich people in Vancouver, Point Grey, who feel better represented by Andrew Wilkinson, and they're probably renters in Colchena that feel better represented by David Eby. So, you know, if they could share their voters a little bit more, maybe we'd all be a little bit happier.
The dual member proportional system that has David Eby and Andrew Wilkinson coming from the same... they are directly adjacent to each other. Honestly, those two ridings are probably going to get amalgamated into one if it becomes a dual member system.
Well, and this just highlights, I think, like for me, one of the strengths of any proportional system is you can give voice to the people who aren't represented by whoever becomes that representative. Like in Vancouver, there are a lot of BC Liberals who aren't being represented by anyone right now. In the rural areas, there are a lot of New Democrats and Greens who aren't represented by anyone. Not as many as there are Liberals, but like I feel like these homeowners in Vancouver Point Grey who are talking about a recall campaign that's never going to happen, by the way, they should be all for PR. And it's not going to happen, because I crunched the numbers on this. To recall an MLA in BC, you need to get signatures from 40% of the registered electors, which, as far as I can tell, is 16,000 people in Vancouver Point Grey. David Eby got 14,000 votes, and the Liberal candidate got 8,000 votes. So if you can double the number of people who bothered to turn up and vote for the Liberal candidate to sign your petition in 60 days, you can get David Eby to lose his job, but it's just not going to happen.
Not at all. Especially because that riding also has a lot of, you know, Kit's rental apartment residents in there, and they are not going to sign a recall petition because someone has to pay school tax on a $3 million plus home. It's just never going to happen. Although the website is somewhat amusing, and they should probably hire an editor.
Maybe they are offering information blows. So these proposals all go to cabinet for approval, and I believe the rumor is that should happen fairly soon. I don't think the provincial government wants to sit on these recommendations until the fall. So we should have a final result, yes or no to this, or maybe some nuance changed very soon. David Eby has said he will not take part in those discussions, despite being part of cabinet, because as attorney general, he was given the job to like decide these rules in an unbiased way, which drew criticism because he is spoken in favor of proportional representation and is a New Democrat, obviously.
Yeah, no politician is unbiased when it comes to what the electoral system should be.
It would have been great to see a citizens' assembly, but in the time they're trying to get
this
through...
That's something else I've seen criticized.
I think the idea of a all-party committee after is the best we can get at this point. A citizens' assembly takes politicians out of it, at least. One of the weaknesses of leaving politicians in charge, even when they're from different parties, is they're looking out for their role as politicians and as MLAs. But no, it seems like we have a debate that can start, and it means we're not talking about pipelines.
So welcome change, although I'm sure that's not going to last, what with our new purchase.
So we'll come back to this a couple more times in the summer. As we said, we'll interview and talk more about dual member proportional. Maybe we'll try and find someone who it was worked on rural-urban proportional to dig into the nuances of that. Everyone knows what MMP is, and by everyone, I mean Europeans.
and probably a lot of the people who listen to the podcast. We have talked about it a decent amount, and we'll once again reference one of our earliest episodes, which is our Electoral Reform Deep Dive. So for our new listeners, if you want to kind of see what we were like at the beginning, you know, you can go back and listen to that somewhat rougher version of the show.
And, you know, we'll keep our eye out and maybe even get a First Past the Post enthusiast on to try and make the case for, you know, sticking with the status quo. Next up for our third segment, What the Fuck, Ontario? We spoke to John Michael McGrath just before we recorded the rest of this to find out what's been going on in the Ontario election. John's the host of TVO's Agenda on Politics podcast, which you should definitely check out. And we just wanted to catch up with him since we last talked to him. Well, welcome back to the podcast, John Michael McGrath. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So Ontario's in the midst of election. Last time we had you on, the Ontario Progressive Conservatives, I think, were just about to choose their leader, and they ended up choosing Doug Ford.
They did indeed.
How did his first few weeks go after that?
Oh boy, it seems like a million years ago now. The initial selection was very rocky, and Doug Ford won his leadership of the party very narrowly, with actually fewer votes from PC members than his nearest competitor, who was Christine Elliott. He also won fewer ridings overall, but because of the way the PC party allocates points in these kinds of contests, he ended up winning overall. So there were a lot of fences that needed to be mended. The party did a lot of very sort of public bridge building to try and bring people together, because, of course, Doug Ford had not had a lot of support from the institutional party when he won. Very few members of the existing PC caucus endorsed him, and his election was seen as, in part, very much a rebuke from certain parts of the PC membership to their own leadership. As time went on, though, the Liberal government presented a budget later in the spring, and Doug Ford did the sort of the traditional role of an opposition leader. He showed up on budget day to the lockup where, I don't know if you guys have done this in BC, but basically for Ontario budget day, you know, a few hundred reporters pile into probably a few dozen reporters pile into a room in downtown Toronto, and we get locked up and our cell phones get taken away. And we spend the day reading and reporting on the budget. But at a certain point, they walk through the finance minister and the two opposition party leaders. And they talk about why the budget is terrible and why they won't be voting for it. And Doug Ford did this thing that is usually sort of boilerplate. And I think it's fair to say it was pretty bizarre. Well, he started off walking into the room saying, and I'm going to mess up the quote exactly, but it was something to the effect of, you know, this is my first lockup. If anybody should be locked up, it's the Liberals. That got played later into people using it as an attack line on him for invoking the Donald Trump lock her up sort of language. And then later in that same media availability, he said something about wanting to cut CBC's funding, and never mind that it's like the wrong level of government. He went on a bit of a tear about, you know, how he thought CBC was dishonest, and then the very next question he had to take from the press gallery was from CBC. So that was probably not the best day that Doug Ford has had in the media. As time has gone on, you know, we've gotten closer to the election. We're now in the election campaign, and things have taken a turn, I guess, in the last few weeks.
Yeah, so before we jump into the election campaign itself, he had a couple of his competitors, and one of them, Tanya Granick-Alec, was the social conservative and delivered a number of those votes to him, as far as I think it was reported, but yet he kind of stabbed her in the back, right?
Yes, so Tanya Granick-Alec is staunchly opposed to a lot of the progressive measures that Kathleen Wynne and the Liberal government have brought in, most especially including the revised physical and sex ed curriculum that the Liberals have introduced. As far as we can tell, you know, the vast majority of her supporters, when she got knocked off the ballot in the progressive conservative leadership race, they went to Doug Ford. fast forward a bit, Tanya Granick Allen was supposed to be the candidate for the Progressive Conservatives in a riding to the west of Toronto. And basically, remarks she had made, we already knew that she had a substantial record of making remarks against the sex education curriculum. Further remarks she had made about gays and lesbians came to light, and Doug Ford announced that she would no longer be the party's candidate. And she has not exactly gone away quietly. Just today, in the public eye, saying the way Doug Ford treated her has in part led to the rise of the New Democratic Party here in Ontario.
Interesting argument to make.
It is. I'm not sure how much credence I give it, but I think it's easy to say historically that the social conservatives in the Progressive Conservative Party have felt that they don't always get listened to, and that they do nurture a bit of a grievance about that sense of the party loves to rely on them for money, doesn't really like to have them take up the spotlight at all.
Well, moving on to the writ period itself, what have been the issues that have been at the center of this election?
Like actual policy issues? There haven't been much.
Well, policy issues, issues about personalities, just kind of what's been the main things people are talking about?
The election started with a handful of policy issues. Doug Ford was recorded during the leadership race telling a room full of people that he wanted to develop housing on the green belt that's like conservation land that surrounds the GTA in Ontario. And this is like a swath of land that is, I think, about the size of PEI in terms of like the square kilometers that are protected from development. And it's one of the last real liberal policies that is still very, very broadly popular. It regularly polls at like 80% support, right? Most politicians simply, if they're ever asked, they say, no, of course, we're not going to build on it. Doug Ford, unfortunately for him, was recorded saying that he thought we should build on it. Within about 24 hours, he turned right around and said, nope. Turns out the Greenbelt's off limits. We're not going to build there after all. More recently, the NDP they've been going up in the polls. They're now either tied or a bit behind the Progressive Conservatives, and the Liberals, led by Kathleen Wynne, have been hammering the NDP hard on their position not to legislate striking workers back to work. Long-held NDP position. Andrea Horvath, the NDP leader, reiterated it during the campaign, and Kathleen Wynne has just hammered away at the NDP for that, saying that an NDP government would either let strikes drag on forever or would effectively give away the store. But overall, the much bigger issues in the election really seem to boil down to a change in government. The Liberals are polling, depending on which poll you look at, either a very little bit above 20%, or in fact below 20% in the polls, distant third. So there seems to be a very pronounced desire for change in government. And then the question is who? The Tories spent most of the spring with very large leads in all of the polls that anybody did, frankly. And that has narrowed substantially during the writ period. The NDP seemed to have become the anybody but Ford option for voters. And we're in the last week of the campaign now, and it's not clear what the actual makeup of the legislature would be. The polls really are so narrow that you could see either party holding a minority or potentially a Tory majority, and there's still, you know, a few more days to go before people make their final decisions.
So why is Kathleen Wynne so unpopular? It feels like it's just she's been around too long. Like, are there actual scandals that have just built up? Or is it just that she's a woman and she's gay and there's some people who are just about that?
That is a very big question. let me see if I can do the answer some justice here. The first thing to say is that the Liberals really have been around for a very long time. 15 years is a long time in modern politics. They have had their share of scandals in terms of misspending or mismanagement at various government agencies. Most of those, however, really predate Kathleen Wynne's time in the Premier's office. The stuff that most people remember as the really sort of gross examples. And, you know, the most long-lived example of this would be the decision to close to, or to not build to, natural gas-fired power plants in the Western GTA will have cost ratepayers $1 billion over the lifespan of the decision. That was made by Wynne's predecessor, Premier Dalton McGuinty at the time. And other decisions, you know, primarily around energy policy that have really increased energy prices in this province. Some of them are laudable. You know, Ontario shut down its coal plants. We now have some of the cleanest electricity, frankly, in the industrialized world. But that came with costs. And the price of electricity has been a constant thorn in the, well, in the voter side, and through the voters, in the side of the Liberal Party. The personal issues about Kathleen Wynne are really hard to measure. The fact that she is a woman and she's openly gay does not explain the entirety of the unpopularity. And I don't want to make it sound like all conservatives are bigots or anything like that. But there's an increment of this unpopularity where, you know, when you look at the opinion polls, she is less popular even than Dalton McGuinty, who was actually responsible for many of the things that she is getting blamed for. And I think there's at least a margin there that you can look at and ascribe some of the vitriol, some of the real nastiness that she faces online and sometimes in person to her gender and to her sexuality.
One of the things that came up here in British Columbia is we had a Liberal government for 16 years, and Christy Clark faced in some ways a lot of those similar challenges as a woman in politics. But I think one of the things that came up for her is just the lack of putting forward a vision to follow the Gordon Campbell era. It was kind of a status quo, maybe build a dam and maybe some big bridges, but nothing that really tackled the affordability. Did Kathleen Wynne coast on the heels a bit like that? Or I kind of got the sense she was willing to, you know, make some bigger steps.
I would say she did. She tried, at least. The problem that Kathleen Wynne faced was that she took office at a time when the Liberals, they'd had a pretty good run for not quite a decade when she took over, from about 2003 to, you know, the 2008, 2009, they had gotten up to the global recession, and they had a growing economy in this province, and they got to expand education funding and other social programs. And then the recession hit, and the province faced enormous deficits, especially Ontario's manufacturing sector, and the manufacturing cities of southwestern Ontario got hit really, really hard by the recession. And the spending problems became really acute, and McGuinty, in fact, leaves under a cloud of effectively people saying that the cuts that were being proposed by the Liberal government to balance the budget were very severe and were really disruptive. Kathleen Wynne takes over the Liberal leadership and the Premier's office and makes the pitch for a much more, I would say, progressive and ambitious government role, but still has to balance the budget. She still, you know, eventually she has to get the provincial budget to back in balance by 2018. And it was always going to be an extremely difficult task. The Liberals have managed to increase some infrastructure spending. They have increased college and university assistance through the student loan program here, OSAP. They have made free prescription drugs available to people under 25 and over 65. So there's been a lot of ambition policy-wise, but the finance minister got up in the legislature last fall in the fall economic statement and said the budget was balanced and it was going to be balanced for next year and the year after that. And then he got up in the legislature this spring with his budget and said, oh, turns out we're running a deficit and we're going to keep running deficits for the next 3 years. I don't know if that was always going to happen, but I think Kathleen Wynne's political instincts were always going to want to lean towards a more generous state versus prioritizing a balanced budget.
Well, let's shift gears a bit on to Andrea Horvath and the NDP. She's been around for several election cycles now as the NDP leader, and from my recollection, didn't particularly connect or run great campaigns in those past years, yet now is on the cusp of becoming premier. What's changed and why is she connecting with Ontarians?
So you're right. She has not done nearly as well in prior elections as she seems to be doing in this one. She became the NDP leader in 2008 after first winning her seat in 2004. She ran her first campaign as leader in 2011, and they won some new seats there. The Liberal Party in the 2011 election was reduced to a minority, and the Liberals and the Conservatives did very well in that election. In 2014, Andrew Horvath ran a far more lackluster campaign, for lack of a better word. There were a bunch of glitches from the very beginning in terms of just the mechanics of running the campaign. And then by the end, a lot of progressive voters in Ontario really came to see the Liberals as the best option for expanding social programs and investing in infrastructure, especially in Toronto, where the Liberals really made transit and infrastructure investment their key theme. The Liberals were able to flip several longtime New Democrats out of their jobs, frankly, including the riding I'm in, that I live in Beaches, East York, had been held by a longtime politician in the area, Michael Prue. He lost his seat. So did Rosario Marchese in one of the most downtown wards in Trinity's, or ridings rather, Trinity Spadina. That was a real sort of reckoning in the New Democratic Party, because they had triggered the election by refusing to support the Liberal budget in 2014. And because the results of the campaign were so disappointing, there were a lot of changes in Horvath's office, including bringing in Michael Balogus, who had worked in previous New Democrat governments in the Prairies. And he has, I would say, it's fair to say, very professionalized the NDP over the last 4 years. They have brought in more staff from other provinces, including BC, and they have run a much more successful campaign this time around. They have also, I think, found their footing. They put out a much more ambitious and progressive platform this time around than they did in the last election or in the 2011 election. And there's certainly a chunk of the electorate that is basically comfortable with the progressive vision that the Liberals and the NDP are both offering, but wants to see a change in government because they either are no longer trust the Liberals, or they just want to see them gone after 15 years. You know, but many of the policies announced in this year's spring budget are, in isolation, very popular. It's when you attach them to the Liberal Party that things get sticky. So the NDP are positioned pretty well with a relatively progressive, relatively ambitious platform, a leader who has always been individually very popular, even if people didn't always vote for her. And it seems to have all come together this time. There have been some hitches. They've been dogged throughout the campaign by basically local candidate issues. A candidate who somehow, she says she did not do it, but a Toronto candidate had there's no other way to say it, a Hitler meme show up on her Facebook page. It's a quote with an old grainy black and white photo of Adolf Hitler from the 30s or 40s, right? The candidate swears she had nothing to do with it, and the party has produced a number of witnesses who talk about her time as an interfaith advocate and activist.
This is the one the Toronto Sun, I think, put on their cover of like Horvath's Hitler connection or something, right? And the quote itself is only just like, if you don't like the rules, break them or something, which seems kind of just benign or banal almost.
Yeah. Nothing's really banal with a Hitler.
No, yeah. And it's weird. I mean, I can kind of get I posted a lot of stupid shit probably when I first got, I don't think I ever posted a picture with Hitler on it. But I mean, I think the Conservatives had that as well, that, you know, local candidate issue.
Yes, Doug Ford has also had to answer for his own local candidates, most prominently Andrew Lawton, former radio host in London, who Ford named to his seat to sort of wrap up the nominations before the election. But Lawton, like, he's an AM talk radio guy who also appeared with the Rebel crowd. He's got a pretty substantial record of saying unpleasant things about Muslims and women and these kinds of things. So, yes, both the NDP and the Progressive Conservatives have had to deal with those issues, but I think it's probably stuck more to the NDP at this point in the race, because you know, it wasn't one or two or three at this point. There seems to be a pretty regular drumbeat of these accusations, including the brother of Jagmeet Singh, the federal NDP leader, is running for a seat in Brampton. And he was photographed more than a decade ago holding a sign at a police protest that says, fuck the police. And, you know, that has been made into many, many days of criticism now. It's been probably the single biggest issue for the NDP, either that or, as I mentioned, the Liberal attacks on their relationship with unions.
Now, the Conservatives have some candidate issues as well, and they also had a scandal surrounding their nominations. Has that really hurt them?
It seemed to, very briefly. Just, I guess, to give some of the background here, there is an allegation that an employee of the privately operated toll highway here in Toronto, the 407 highway, there is an allegation that private user data from the 407 corporation made its way to the Progressive Conservative Party, either to individual candidates or perhaps to the party collectively. The party denies this. There are police investigations going on. The question that the party is facing is, did this data make its way into party's databases? Are people, has people's personal information been, you know, violated, essentially? And it also is wrapped up in this broader question with the PC party of how legitimate the party's internal nominations processes are. Under the previous leader, Patrick Brown, there were numerous complaints and, in fact, several lawsuits and, again, a police investigation or two into the conduct of the local riding nominations to name PC candidates. You have to understand that the Progressive Conservatives, they had been by far the most popular party in the polls for more than a year. In fact, at least 2 years, I think. And so they were having a hard time just trying to manage their nomination races because everybody thought this was going to be the horse to back. This was going to be a ticket to a new career in politics. And so they had a huge number of new members, legitimate actual people, and as well as some allegations of fake people. They had really energetically contested nominations. And the allegation that the National Post and the Globe and Mail have reported on is that at least some of these riding nominations were swung on behalf of various members of the political leadership of the party by basically bussing in fake party members by the tens and twenties, at least. The Globe and Mail, I think, had the description of a computer and printer spitting off fake identifying papers for fake party members to use to prove that they could vote in certain ridings. It's an incredibly messy situation. And at this point, I don't know if we're actually ever going to know the truth of what happened in all of it. But as that story broke over a period of several days, the Tories did take a serious hit in the public opinion polls. And that was where you saw the fastest climb for the NDP. And the polls that were taken closest to the real height of this discussion were some of the ones that actually showed the NDP in the lead. That seems to have petered off now. I think the issue is not getting discussed as much at the moment, but it would not surprise me if the NDP tried to bring it up again in the last week of the election.
Well, going into this last week, we'll let you go here in a minute.
Yeah.
I know it's getting late there. What are you going to be watching for on election night or in this last week? And I guess, you know, sort of over the next week and then going into election night, which seats are going to be in play? What regions do you think are in play?
Well, I mean, in the sense that for the Liberal Party, it's actually very hard to see where a safe seat for them is at the moment. The CBC poll tracker that I've been sort of, my eyeballs have been glued to for the last few weeks suggests that they could end up with one seat in Eastern Ontario. It's probably Ottawa-Vanier, but that would mean that the governing party, which, you know, held a majority of seats when the legislature was dissolved, could be all but annihilated in the polls. because that's true, it means that there are seats basically all over up for grabs. But the most seats that are really at play are Toronto and the suburbs around Toronto. It's just where the demographic center of the province really is. So you're going to see the New Democrats and the Tories fighting for seats basically everywhere. If the Tories win this election, it's going to be in part because they're going to be winning seats in Toronto for the first time in, I want to say, like 20 years. I think maybe one or two Tories hung on to seats in 99, but after 2003, the Liberals have basically held almost a total lock on seats in Toronto itself, ever since they won in 2003. The other issue to keep an eye on, though, that we'll get at least some hint about early next week, or early in the last week, is turnout. And Elections Ontario should be releasing on Monday or Tuesday, I believe, the count for how many people took advantage of advanced voting. In the last election, it was, I think, about 300,000 or so. So anything more than that could signal a higher turnout election. The conventional wisdom at the moment is that a higher turnout election would be better for the New Democrats, and a more conventional or lower turnout election is probably going to be better for the Progressive Conservatives. So yeah, I'll be looking for the Elections Ontario release whenever that comes out. The only other thing that I would say that I'm going to be really looking for is just the sign of, if it's necessarily going to be looking at polls and maybe a bit of scanning social media, but just trying to get a sense of whether Liberal voters reconsider their second choice. Most of the polls we see show that Liberal voters by far prefer the NDP to Doug Ford. That's not a surprise. The question is going to be whether on voting day they stick with the party that they identify themselves as, or do they cast a strategic vote for the NDP to stop Doug Ford. If they start doing that in large numbers, then there really aren't a lot of safe seats at all for the Liberals, and they could, in fact, get, you know, cut down to that one or two seats. I've seen some people predict zero. I don't think it's going to get that bad, but it's not going to be a good night for the Liberals one way or the other. But the flip side could be true. You know, the Liberals have edged up very, very slightly in the polls in the last week, and some people could come home, and the way that, I don't have to tell you guys, the way First Past the Post works, if enough Liberal voters come home, they could save a handful of seats at the cost of probably putting the Progressive Conservatives in government.
Well, do you actually have any predictions on how you think it's going to play out?
No, I have no idea. I mean, the polls are so tight that literally a 2 or 3% swing can move a lot of seats, and the reality of polling is just that nobody actually has that kind of precision, right? I mean, the margin of error is larger than the margin of victory, and it would be silly for me to give a hostage to fortune and make a prediction with you guys. I'll say I don't expect the Liberals to form government after June 7th.
That's probably a safe bet. If it does go into a minority parliament, where do you think the various parties are going to position themselves?
That's a big question, and it's one we've all been trying to suss out. I certainly know that there are Liberals who will say frankly that they believe, you know, if the NDP form government, it's going to form a permanent problem for the Liberal Party. That if voters get used to the idea of the NDP as a regular force in government, and if the NDP don't blow it, of course, because it's actually, you know, being in government is hard. So there's definitely a wing of the Liberal Party that believes that if you could keep Doug Ford to one term in government and turn the party around and then come back in the next election, that might be more beneficial. On the other hand, the kinds of Liberals who are fondest of Kathleen Wynne, and who, frankly, they might get some very progressive Liberals to keep their seats by, you know, coming home to them, if there's that minority and the remaining Liberals are from that sort of Kathleen Wynne-aligned, most progressive part of the Liberal Party, you could see them make a deal with the NDP just out of an instinct to preserve Kathleen Wynne's legacy and, by the way, preserve the Liberal Party. I mean, one of the things I haven't talked about here is that to differing degrees, the Liberals and the NDP both are relying on a per-vote subsidy that the Liberals introduced, similar to the old federal one, that for both parties, I mean, for the Liberals, it's one of the things backing a lot of debt for that party. And if Doug Ford is elected, he said he would eliminate that per-vote subsidy, which would certainly hurt the NDP. And depending on how bad election night is for the Liberals, it could be catastrophic for them. So the short answer that I haven't given you, I'll try now. The short answer is I don't know where the Liberals would land. There are any number of ways that it could go. I suspect if Doug Ford has a strong minority, let's say, like if he's only one or two seats shy of the 63 he needs to form a majority, I suspect that the Liberals will simply sit on their hands. That's my sort of cynical suspicion, that they will let Ford get a throne speech and a budget in while they try to rebuild their party. But I've said that to other Tories, for example, who don't believe it at all. I've spoken to Tories who say that the pressure from the Liberal base to keep Doug Ford out of office will be so intense that the Liberal Party will have to form some kind of governing agreement with the NDP. Those are really the possibilities. There's also the possibility that Mike Schreiner, the leader of the Green Party, could win the seat he's running for in Guelph, which would make our calculations even more complicated.
I was just about to ask about him.
Yeah, I'm sure your listeners know more than I do about how a small Green Party caucus can complicate politics.
Yeah. All right, well, I think we've taken up enough of your time, and thank you so much for joining us this evening. Maybe just remind our listeners where they can find you and where they can find your podcast.
Right. I am on Twitter at JM_McGrath. You can find all of my writing for TVO at tvo.org. And our podcast is The Agenda on Politics with me, John Michael McGrath. And we are on iTunes and Google Play.
Will your show be continuing after the election?
We will be doing at least one or two episodes after the election. And then we are going to call it a season for the summer. And then we will come back in the fall. That's like our current plan anyway, is to come back in the fall with the legislature when it returns.
Well, no one here got a summer last year, so hopefully you do.
We're hoping that we at least get July.
Thanks for joining us.
All right. Thanks so much for having me.
Have a good night. Well, and in Quick Takes this week, because the episode's running a bit long, we just have one story, and the Quick Take this week is the pipeline, of course. We can't get, you know, a day without talking about it these days. Do go back and check out the emergency podcast we put up on Tuesday. That has all our full takes about the buyout and all of that. Thank you for the people who've downloaded it and given us good feedback on it. The news today, not much has changed really since then, but there's a story out of Alberta where I believe it's the Chipewyan Band up in the Fort McMurray area. A few of the Indigenous nations up there have said, you know what, we're actually interested in that like pipeline that you mentioned for sale. And they handed a letter off to Rachel Notley saying, hook us up. We're interested. Make us an offer. When Bill Morneau announced this sale, he talked about, in very vague ways, like the Indigenous nations, other oil companies, such and such groups that were expressing interest. And that sounded like a bit of bluster to try to justify a deal, and maybe it wasn't entirely so. And, you know, if they can sell this pipeline off piece by piece, maybe some shares here to these Indigenous nations that can afford this amount, some shares to probably Chinese oil companies, and some shares to a few other groups, they might be able to not lose a ton of money on it in the end. This is a great deal still. These nations are specifically interested in it, I think, because they tend to be based around Fort McMurray. So a lot of their profit sharing has to do with oil sands extraction. And so if oil sands product can't get to market at the best rate, they stand to not make as much. So they have a direct interest. It just challenges the, you know, solidarity of different Indigenous nations when you have ones at one end of the pipeline going, this should really go through, and ones at this end of the pipeline going, it really shouldn't.
It makes the discussion, I think, a lot more nuanced, which is good, because there definitely is a tendency in the media to kind of paint with a very broad brush and gloss over the differences between various groups' interests in the pipeline.
And I think even within nations, because you can have some places where leadership may have signed a deal, but not really like fully debated the issue within their nation, because they're each structured slightly differently. And so, especially in BC, where you don't necessarily have formal structures, right? Because you don't have treaties and territories, so everyone's just kind of claiming it goes through their traditional territory. It's complicated, and Canada's Indigenous communities is not a monolith. And so, yeah, I definitely agree there should be nuance in this, and I can totally appreciate different perspectives.
And yeah, and this wouldn't be unprecedented. We, I believe, mentioned a couple weeks ago about the Eagle Spur pipeline that's being proposed for up north near the Alaska border, like literally right on the border, basically.
Putting all of the tankers off Canadian waters.
Possibly. The final details haven't been worked out, but we'll refer you back to a quick take from a week or two ago to touch on that.
Well, in relating to this idea of selling Trans Mountain off in lots of different parts, which still isn't confirmed, this is just an expression of interest in sale. One of the other things that came up, or that I did see this week, was I think Petronas has actually started buying into the LNG Canada project up north.
Yeah, they actually just announced a major investment in LNG in BC.
So we're seeing lots of things happen in different ways with different investors, and the LNG is interesting based on, you know, the NDP and Greens' tenuous relationship, and we know how much the Greens hate LNG, but the Liberals are always pretty fond of it.
And
but now the NDP is doing better at it.
Or at least willing to give even more corporate welfare out.
So we'll keep our eye on the pipeline and the LNG. Energy is always going to be a contentious issue in BC, and we've definitely not heard the end of the Trans Mountain pipeline story.
Moving on to Best of BC Polity from Justin McElroy.
I think this one... All right, go ahead, and then I'll do my bit.
Yeah, so this was related to a press conference news ad on Monday regarding new housing for women and children fleeing violence. We're at the end of it. Justin tweets this out. The presser with Horton ends. He then shouts, Kinder Morgan, into the microphone because he says he was surprised he didn't have to say those words during the Q&A. And in brackets, it was weird. So this was the day before the whole pipeline buyout happened.
Right. Yeah, I was going to say this Best of BC Poly belongs to the premier. Like, because we've given it to Justin McElroy before because he tweets humorously, then you should follow him. But I just want to point out what an absurd man-child of a premier we have. Not in a bad way, but in an adorable way of just like the kind of guy who screams random things into microphones before leaving, not because he's off his rocker or, you know,
well,
unstable, but
we'd
just
assume
because,
not, but or at least yeah, we hope
we
not.
Haven't seen any other evidence. It's just more he has a sense of humor about it. He likes telling dad jokes, and apparently this is his sense of humor.
Although he did think Voyager was better than Deep Space Nine, which really leads me to question his judgment.
Were either good Star Trek, though?
Yes, Deep Space Nine was amazing.
Well, and calling back to our discussion of Horgan's bizarre comparison with JFK, Brad Zubik this week tweeted at John Horgan just compared his PR referendum to JFK challenging his country to go to the moon. As weird as that is, I guess he could be correct if JFK and his cabinet ignored the engineers and scientists and built the rockets themselves. If you want, you can follow Brad Zubik at BZUBYK. Well, if you have strong opinions about Star Trek series, tweet them at us at Politicos Pod. If you find good tweets on the BC Poly scene, tweet them to hashtag Best of BC Poly or tag us at Politicos Pod, or just DM them to us if you don't want us to name us. Also, at BC Poly Portraits was outed this past week. Her name is Zoe. She's done a self-portrait on her own. She's a staffer to the one of BC Liberal MLAs who outed her during their like final statements, because I guess all of the MLAs took an extended period. This week was really weird in the legislature. They didn't debate any bills. They just like finished estimates and debated PR for an hour for fun, and then like had an extended thank you to all their staff and friends, which is fine, which is nice. But hopefully they will be back in the fall and doing more bills, because there's definitely things I'm waiting for this government to do. But over the summer, we will undoubtedly have more to talk about with pipelines, Hopefully we can line up some special guests and do some more deep dives and policy talk.
And that has been Politicos. Find links to the stories we mentioned in the show notes at politicos.ca. Make sure to subscribe or listen to podcasts and follow us on Facebook and Twitter at PolitosPod. Leave us a review and let us know what you think. Support the show and get early access to interviews at patreon.com/politicos. And if you have ideas for the show, feel free to send them to us. Thanks for listening.